VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, Spurs get a point at Stamford Bridge in controversial circumstances. Are you Team Tuchel or Team Conte? We'll discuss the latest battle at the bridge. We'll also be talking about the Brentford Community Stadium, where Manchester United, frankly speaking, didn't show up. How big a result is that? Not just for Manchester United and their woes, but for an ever-improving Brentford side. We'll also be speaking about Nottingham Forest, who hosted their first Premier League match for 23 years. We'll hear from Matt Dickinson about his new book on 1999 and Manchester United. And we'll also be asking you for your favourite assists. This is The Game. Hello again, welcome back to The Game. I'm Hugh Woozencroft, alongside Alison Rudd, Gregor Robertson and Tom Clark, after a pretty uneventful weekend of Premier League action. I'm only jesting, obviously. It was absolutely incredible. Peak Barclays, I think, is what they call it. Inject it, inject it, inject it. Those are all the memes, right? It was unbelievable. And we've got to start at Stamford Bridge. I think just about edged it over the Brentford Community Stadium. Maybe because it was just... It's Monday morning.
Maybe because you really wanted.
It's Monday morning. It's what the kids are talking about, right? We'll come to events on Saturday afternoon very, very shortly. I've already been told that I'm in a grumpy mood this morning. My reaction to events with a 2-2 draw, Spurs, Harry Kane-ish, with a 96 minute equaliser. Still think it was a Reece James own goal. So you get an indication of the sort of mood I'm in today, all right? Spurs were meant to be sending a message in this game, okay? And they didn't send a message. I don't care if they drew 2-2. I don't care how happy their fans were. I don't care. I don't care. All I saw in this game was a Tottenham Hotspur team who ain't going to get close to winning a Premier League title. We're going to come to all of the arguments with Tuchel and Conte in a bit. Let's start with the football. Tottenham were outplayed. In my opinion.
And that is why they had every right to celebrate, you. Because the Spurs of old would play pretty football and lose and stand around looking at the skies thinking, how did that happen? We're such an elegant team and we've got Harry Kane. Now they can play boring football, be outclassed, be outplayed, not look terribly aesthetically pleasing, somehow ride the wave of many, many decisions that went their way that shouldn't have, and suddenly find themselves in the position of grabbing a point at the death. That will feel like a win, and don't you dare pretend you haven't felt like a win isn't a win, but it's a draw and it feels like a win. And a draw can feel like a defeat if it's taken away from you. That's the way football is, and you should celebrate the fact that it's a complex emotional situation. So I think, wow, they're not flaky. They can play beautiful and get the draw that they didn't deserve, which is like a win, getting a draw you don't deserve.
I actually think you've given them too much credit in terms of their performance by what you just said there.
I haven't given them any credit.
Not aesthetically pleasing. No, that was much better than they actually played, to be perfectly honest with you. They were barely in the game, Alisson. Listen, they scored a couple of goals, fine, but the question was, what message did they send to the rest of the Premier League?
They're nasty. They've got a nasty edge now, and that's new.
They pulled the hair of people with lots
indeed.
Of lovely hair.
No one wants to condone that, but Romero's little battle with Havertz as well was kind of box office. Obviously on the touchline, that was box office. You're right, they're absolutely right. They were outplayed for large swathes of the game. Richarlison came on, and although that also kind of created a bit of a
was
weakness.
Was involved in both of the goals.
Well done, Tom, yeah. I thought you'd be delayed with that. but we know what he's like as well. I think he would have been seething on the touchline, chomping a bit to get on. And
And yet he came running on the pitch as though he had North London pumping through his veins, as though that was all he'd ever wanted in his life, was to represent the team in white. I mean, these are qualities that Spurs have not had. Signing new players who act like they have joined the elite and are beyond excited to be part of it.
I think what we learned is, you're right, they're not at the level to be competing for the Premier League title, but they really want to be. And that's a change as well. I think it's like, you know, well, although we're maybe not quite there yet, we want to be there, and we're doing everything we can to be there.
This is biased commentary, because almost any other team, if they had come away from Stamford Bridge, that's the best I've seen Chelsea play for quite some time,
that's
I have
true
to
as
say.
Well. Yeah.
To come away from Stamford Bridge with a point when it's not clicked for you. You know you can click, because in the previous match you did click and got lots of praise. To come away from Stamford Bridge with that atmosphere, being outplayed, trying to integrate new signings, getting it at the death, that speaks to me of a team that isn't going to win the title, but they're going to finish top four.
So you would have been feeling the same way if Liverpool had played like that and got that result?
I don't know what it feels like to be a fan of a team that are flaky, so I wouldn't. I wouldn't.
Tom Clark, what message did Spurs send?
Well, you can probably read it on the cover of the game pullout today, and I'm going to say that because I came up with the headline. Not so Spursy anymore. And I'm going to give Tony Cascarino full credit, because I was also ghostwriting his column yesterday. And he kind of said that what Alisson said, which is we can flip this conversation on its head and say Chelsea were superb. That was absolutely brilliant, I think. And Thomas Tuchel deserves a lot of credit for what was and would have been hailed as a tactical masterclass had they seen that victory out. But Tottenham showed all those qualities that Alisson's talked about, and they're not qualities that they've shown before, even under Pochettino. So, and Tony Cascarino's point was that at this stage in the season, that kind of a performance, when you've got players coming off the bench and looking like it's the most important game of their lives, when you've got Eze Bissouma fist pumping to the fans at the end of the game, you're only at the start of the season, but that can be a really unifying factor for a group of players, some of whom are only new teammates. So I think that's the message it sends. Not so Spursy anymore.
I can't have it. It was embarrassing. The end of the game was embarrassing. I know, listen, it's a huge game for all Spurs fans. It's Chelsea away from home, one win in 30 years. So, you know, a draw, why not celebrate it like it's a win? I didn't get it. Eze Bissouma's second game for Spurs, and he's there like Jurgen Klopp, punching to the Spurs fans.
It's a great bit of PR. Come on.
Cheering his every punch as if they won the game. Embarrassing. Harry Kane's post-match interview, he called it a winner. You're meant to be a team capable of winning the Premier League. That's all.
Who says that?
That is all. The conversation has been Spurs can challenge. Has it not been?
No, so they can get closer, and yes, they should be like comfortably in the top four rather than sneaking in the last day.
In that case, since no one fancies Tottenham and doesn't think they're that good, then I take it all back.
No, come on, let's not overspin this. We had a conversation on Thursday's podcast talking about this game, and one genius, I can't remember who it was, it might have been me, said that Chelsea will probably show what a superior team they are and maybe win the game 2-1, or maybe it'll be a draw. And they did that. So, you know, and Tottenham got a point. And that is showing.
And Charleston got minutes.
And he stood in front of the keeper for the first goal, and he was jumping in the air with Kane for the second as well. Huge, huge impact. Already seeing it. No, but like, I think you can have Tottenham improving in various ways that we've talked about: character, spirit, fight, and be seen, as Alisson said, as a top four. Not certainty yet. Obviously, it's very early days, but seen as
that's the minimum expectation.
Yeah, a minimum expectation, and that is an incremental growth on what they were at last season.
If Spurs had shown that character and tenacity in the original Battle of the Bridge, they would have won the title.
I'm not sure.
Good point. I agree.
They might have got closer to winning the title. Yeah, obviously they would, but I think Leicester still would have won it. Was that the same season?
Yeah, that's the Battle of the Bridge. That's the original Battle of the Bridge.
I still think Leicester would have got over the line. No?
Spurs threw that away.
Okay. What about Chelsea? What message did they send? Tom?
Superb. Thomas Tuchel. I mean, like, again, I'm being very silly here, but we did talk about it on Thursday's show, that as much as Antonio Conte is being praised for being a brilliant coach, and isn't he fantastic, look what he's done. I think Tuchel deserves so much credit for a kind of slightly turbulent summer, lots of change off the pitch for Chelsea, still bringing in new players. That was absolutely brilliant. They completely dominated Tottenham. They dominated in midfield, which is something that we discussed on Thursday's show. I thought they pretty much nullified Son and Kane with the way that they defended, both in terms of just not just the back three, but the way in which the wing back slotted back in and made it a back five quite a lot of the time and suffocated that space in which Kane and Son like to operate. I thought Koulibaly, as James Gearbrandt's written this morning, was superb. I think for Chelsea, the only thing is that they didn't win the game. In terms of going ahead this season, my expectations for Chelsea, when you know you're already throwing your predictions out the window in the prediction show, we were talking about, oh god, they might struggle to finish in the top four. They now look like that third place team again already, and that's incredibly impressive, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. It was the best I've seen Chelsea in a long, long time, and a big part of that was N'Golo Kanté, and so to see him like being shot in the hamstring towards the end was an enormous blow. But the energy and sort of dynamism, and as Tom said, the way they pressed and bit into the tackle, and then Conor Gallagher came on and did the same. He's like a mini Mason Mount, really, isn't he? It's like a carbon copy, and I think we'll see him playing soon from the start. And Havertz looked like he's got a bit of bite, you know. He's like, it's not really what we thought he was when he first came.
It's his new jarhead haircut, isn't it?
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, well, he was right up for it. He kind of ran into Romero and barged into him. It was great.
And every manager must be coveting Reece James. I mean, the energy he showed. But his job was to man-mark Son and occasionally man-mark Harry Kane. I mean, I imagine being in a team meeting and you're told that's your job. And then the minute Tuchel said, OK, I'm giving you freedom to belt down the wing and be more attacking, almost instantly he scores a goal and affects the game completely. He was clearly the man of the match, I thought.
The thing, you know, sort of counterpoint to that is that Conte was praised for bringing on Richarlison and, you know, mixing up. He stretched the play and gave Spurs a bit more space. But Ben Davis was left like woefully exposed on the left, and you saw Son. It was Son chasing Reece James back when he ran down the line and whipped in the cross for Havertz and missed a sitter. You thought, oh, that's not going to work, and then he scored a few minutes later from again because there was far too much space. So like, I'm not sure that was the kind of masterstroke that everyone painted out to put Richarlison on, but you can't have Son doing the job of basically of a left wing back.
Yeah.
So you know, although it did a lot for Tottenham to kind of, you know, impose themselves in the game, it also left a gaping hole.
The one thing that I noticed, and I thought Chelsea were absolutely brilliant, was really the front three. Havertz, you cannot hang your hat on him, as good as he played, to score you the goals to win you these games. I thought he played really, really well. We had this conversation last year, earlier this year, about Lukaku going out on loan. I haven't felt, and I don't think Chelsea feel, that Havertz is going to score them the goals that they need to really challenge in any of their competitions this season, hence the Aubameyang thing. I do think Aubameyang is a very different type of player to Havertz, and there's going to be some sort of change there in the way that they play if Aubameyang does come into the club. Because Havertz's link-up play is just, it's totally different to the way that Aubameyang wants to play. And it's worked for Chelsea, you know, largely last season with Havertz there, even though he doesn't score the goals. And this is what I mean. It's just about that goal-scoring element, because I still think he's been excellent. But the other thing that I noticed is, you know, Sterling is sort of an inside forward with wing-backs, and I know we've seen him play it for England. We know with England, he is not the same Raheem Sterling that he was at Manchester City, as good as a player he is, but this isn't international football. And really, a player of his quality should be playing in their best position / in their best role every single week. And as an inside forward with a wing-back overlapping, that is not where you want Raheem Sterling.
I agree in terms of the positional thing. I come back to something that we all discussed, and Gregor and I were making the point in the preview show, is that Sterling, to me, is a player about relationships on the pitch with teammates, and it's obviously very early for that. And I agree with you, Hugh. There are a few moments where there was a moment in the second half where he was kind of one-on-one on the edge of the box and tried to kind of take on Tottenham defender, got tackled, and I was like, that exactly looks like what happens for England. He kind of, it's do it yourself, otherwise you're not going to kind of get the lovely intricate passing that you get for Manchester City, which results in a tap in at the back post. But that's the challenge for Tuchel now, is to try and make sure that Sterling can develop those relationships. The other option is to bring in a striker like Aubameyang, but then you're working on again to change the system, to change the style again. I think we have to give five or six games to see whether Sterling can develop those relationships with the likes of Havertz.
You know, there was a point in the first half as well where the ball just got swung in from the right and it was Sterling against two defenders, you know, fighting for a header, and you're just like, that's not going to work. You can't play that way to Raheem Sterling. You know, physically, he's just not going to be able to do it. So they do need to change something going forward, Chelsea. I think on another day, maybe with a Lukaku type, they probably win that game.
Yeah, you could kind of draw a parallel with Manchester City last season, but the thing that they had was so many players that shared out the goals. There's so many players even behind the front three that were chipping in with goals. You don't really see that with the Chelsea starting lineup there. Reece James will. You know, Silva and Koulibaly might get a few from set plays, but
this is the thing.
The midfielders won't.
The way that they are playing now, space in behind for the forwards to run into, there's none. Like they dominated the game against Tottenham the way that you'd expect them to dominate a lot of games, you know, probably not against Spurs, but against teams lower down the league, in that they were able to have those Spurs defenders right back in their penalty area, right on the edge of the box. No space for Raheem Sterling to make a run off the wing into that space behind that he loves to do. Aubameyang loves to run into space behind. You're sitting there thinking, you know, the best part of those two players' games, we don't know if Aubameyang's going to go to Chelsea, looks likely, but is not the way that Thomas Tuchel likes to play. So how's he going to get the best out of them? That was a concern for me watching that game. And I agree with all of you. Chelsea were better than I've seen them for a long, long time.
Do you think, Hugh, when you went to bed on Sunday night, that Raheem Sterling was frustrated or disappointed? Because I thought he looked very comfortable, very at home. I thought he looked happier than I've seen him for a while playing football. I think he likes the vibe at Chelsea. And I think he'll happily do whatever's required. And yeah, he should have scored and didn't score. But my point is
not about his happiness. It's about
his
productivity.
Raheem Sterling is something anyone wants in their squad, isn't it?
Yeah, but when we reach the end of the season and Raheem Sterling might have 7 goals and 8 assists and everyone's saying he's not the Sterling that he was at Manchester City, he might not be happy then. It's all about him. You know, footballers are going to be happy, especially in his position, scoring and assisting and having a real effect on the game. And all I'm saying is it didn't look like, watching Chelsea play how they played, that he's going to have the same effect on football matches that he did when he was playing for Pep at Manchester City.
I think it's too early to say that, personally. Yeah. I think he was good. He was really
good.
Got to
say something. They paid me.
He was really good against Everton. He was the best player, really, I thought. You know, I agree with Alisson. I think he's someone who you can play several roles, and I think he's pleased he's going to be kind of a bit more of a main man now at City as well. Yeah, similar to some of the other transfers we've seen this summer.
How much did we enjoy Tuchel versus Conte during the match, at the end of the match? Did anyone think it was a little bit beneath two managers of such esteem? I might as well start with you, Alison.
Well, I can offer a bit of insight here, actually, because Tuchel said, he admits, you know, passions were high, both managers were, you know, on that level. But he said he grabbed hold of his hand in the handshake because he didn't make eye contact and he felt in the heat of the moment that was rude. Well, having been at an awful lot of Antonio Conte press conferences, he does not look you in the eye. He never looks you in the eye. He looks around your head, at your knees, at your toes, something on the horizon. He's not an eye contact person. He does that thing where he smiles and his eyes twinkle and he looks engaging, but he doesn't actually look at you. So it was not an insult. It's just the way he is.
Okay. Did you enjoy the
game? Oh, I enjoyed it enormously. But it was there was no need for Tuchel to be quite so angry. But I mean,
Mark Hughes used to always do that. Remember, Mark Hughes had so many spats on the touchline because with handshake spats, basically.
Yeah.
And it was often that was often.
But there was there was a handshake. I mean, that's the point. Often we get cross because they don't
do it at all.
They don't shake hands, and that's ridiculous because it isn't war, it is sport. So you must shake hands.
Look,
they
it was box office stuff. Let's be honest. Do we like it? Yes, we love it. We love it. But you know, I even like Conte at the end saying, look, we want to kill our opponent in the right way. they want to. If we don't, they'll kill us.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's deeply sort of embedded in the psyche of these top, like, managers who do anything they can to win. So, you know, you just saw that spilling out. It was brilliant.
Yeah, I just thought Conte celebrating towards Tuchel.
It's not classy, but it's great to watch.
At 1-1 with, like, how long to go? It was just a bit, you know, and then Tuchel running down the touch. Oh, come on, guys.
But he will, honestly, Hugh, you're missing it. He will build on the character they showed in that match. They will use what they achieved in that game to see them through all sorts of sticky moments to come.
Yeah, he's back at his former club, and you've got Aspilicueta coming up nearly like the two of them were getting pulled apart at the end. You know, he's very much a Tottenham man now.
And I think in terms of Alisson talking about Conte building on it for Tottenham, I think this was a little bit of a like rebirth for Tuchel as well in terms of Chelsea and everything that they've gone through, lots of player changes as well. We've talked, and seemingly wrongly, about, oh, is it all going to unravel? Like, this felt like a, no, he's really got them tactically going, and my God, he's up for it. And I actually disagree with Alisson. I think he had every right to be as angry as he was. And his post-match chat with Sky afterwards was an absolute masterclass in pettiness. I absolutely loved it. In terms of the sass that he showed, that was far more entertaining to me than any of the spats on the touchline.
No, I'm not saying he wasn't right to be cross. I'm saying he's wrong to pick on the eye contact thing. Everything else, he had the right to be cross about.
Fine.
You happy with that? Or
yeah, just about. I'll just make sure next time I shake hands with Alisson where her eyes go.
Speaking of his post-match comments, Thomas Tuchel, he's going to be in a bit of hot water, isn't he? He suggested that maybe it would be better if Anthony Taylor didn't referee Chelsea matches anymore. I just checked the petition. It's gone past 87,000. The Chelsea fans not happy with Anthony Taylor. Well, it's all part of Barclays, isn't it? Petitions. It's all part of the love of the... This is why it's the best league in the world, right? For petitions. I thought Anthony Taylor had a particularly bad game. I don't think he was helped at the end of the game by VAR. I thought some of his decisions were appalling. There was one that particularly infuriated me, which actually led to the whole scenario. The free kick in the corner. I know this wasn't even one of the big decisions, where Harry Kane just nudged it past Reece James and then threw himself to the ground, which was a clear as day a dive as you will ever see.
Nonsense.
Missed the Bentancur foul. Awful decision. VAR. Yes, I'm sorry. VAR. I can't even blame Anthony Taylor for this one. How on earth do you not ask the on-field referee to look at the how can you not? I don't even care if you give it or not. Are you telling me there was literally not enough there to ask the on-field referee? I think you need to look at that, because we all saw Romero try and pull Mark Kukurea's head off. We all saw it. It was there. It was clear. That was clear. All right. So all I'm saying is, where's the bar? Are you telling me that what did he need to do for you to ask that in that situation? What does Romero need to do to Kukurea for you to send Anthony Taylor over? Does he need to swing from his hair? What does he need to do? What does he need to do? I couldn't believe that you wouldn't. I don't care if it would have changed the game or not. But what is the point of VAR? I've said it so many times on the podcast. VAR light will not work. What percentage does it need to be? 5% violent conduct? 25%? 50% before you say you should have a look? Not even give the decision. Have a look.
But they don't want them to do that anymore.
That's VAR light.
If the official on the pitch is saying, and we don't know what they're saying to each other, but he's probably asked, did you see that? And he's saying, yeah, it was a bit handbags. You're not going to make him stroll over to the monitor to watch himself interpret something the same way, because it slows the game down. We're trying to speed things up and not re-referee.
It wasn't. There's no way they thought that. All they thought was, we don't want to make a big decision at this point in a game of such high magnitude, so we're just going to not get involved. They didn't think they weren't sitting around going, I can't see anything there. They all saw him pull the hair. They just went, nah. Look, the referee was right in front of it. The game's almost done. Let's just get out of here. They honestly thought it wasn't going to make a difference. They didn't want to get involved. They are getting paid to do absolutely nothing. The whole point of them being there is to make sure we get to the right decisions. Get the referee over to the screen and make sure you get the right decision. Because there was... Are we going to sit around and say there was nothing there?
It could have been a yellow card. And that's not what VAR is there
but
to
do. It could
do.
Have been a red card, which is what it's there to do.
Yeah, but if it's not a red card, you don't stop the game. You don't replay the game for somebody that isn't a red card.
But is there no chance it was a red card? Absolutely 0% red.
It was a red for me.
Oh, okay.
But if you're...
Gregor?
If you're not giving a red, you can't do anything.
0% red?
We all think it's clear cut, but there's a chance that they don't. Just like you said, Reece James went over and Harry Kane dived. I absolutely, categorically disagree with you there.
That.
Harry Kane was smart. Reece James was naive.
Yeah.
It's a foul.
Okay.
So there's a chance. It's not like...
But that's different. I can understand that.
It's not like a two-foot tackle.
I thought it was a bad...
It's weird. It's not something you see every day.
I understand that. But that's a free kick. Hundreds of them a game. someone's hair being pulled.
It's weird.
If you're, if you're,
most people don't have hair long enough to be pulled.
But well, listen,
as bushy, as easily grabbable.
Oh, which reminds me, I've only just thought about this. I spent the whole game saying, well, if I was his manager, Cucurella's manager, I would not allow him to run around the pitch bobbing away like that with his hair. And because I have similar, I mean, not similar, but I have as much hair.
Yes.
And when I play football, played, I don't play anymore. When I played football, I put it back, and I would insist if I was a manager that every player with lots of hair puts it back.
It impedes your
peripheral vision.
Cane Rose.
It's very irritating to watch. So I can see why it's really tempting to pull it. I mean, it's like brings out all the sort of childish instincts to go behind the girl in the class with the pigtails and go yank, yank, yank. We were discussing this. Would not be discussing this if he had his hair, in a man bun. Why doesn't he put it in a man bun?
Who doesn't like the man bun? Speaking as someone who grew their hair very long during lockdown. Yeah, but exactly. And I didn't wear it in a man bun that often. I kept it down because it was a lesser of two evils.
The one thing I'll say in favour of Erling Haaland, he's prepared to look a bit naff with his ponytail man bun thing.
His barnet looks horrendous either way.
It stops him from it affecting his game. And this is absolute proof why you should tie your hair back properly if you've got lots of it.
Who was it pulled David Luiz's hair?
What game?
There was a couple. There was also the brilliant thing that I was reminded of this morning.
Fellaini.
Van Gaal's post-match after Fellaini got the hair pulled, where he talked about sex masochism. That was a real highlight of his tenure at Times with Manchester
United. But there was a retrospective red for that.
Yes, there was.
Yeah. Listen, you can't pull someone's hair.
No.
I
think we've talked enough.
I'm moving on from this. But seriously, I don't see how anyone can say that the VAR official shouldn't have asked Anthony Taylor to look at the screen.
I agree with you.
There's absolutely no way.
It was odd.
It's an absolute dereliction of duty. Don't go in the VAR booth. Don't watch the game if you don't want to make a decision and if you don't want to get involved.
What you cannot do is say, it's what you're asking for. They cannot say to the referee, go and look at that again. All they can do is to say that you've missed a definite red card offence. And that's the end of it. That's all they're supposed to be doing. You can't keep re-refereeing, Hugh.
It's all right. It's fine. It's all right, guys. Don't worry. Yeah. We've done a big chunk on Chelsea and we're going to calm Hugh down by moving on to Brentford 4, Manchester United.
Just before we do, given that you ghosted Tony's excellent column this weekend, can we just briefly discuss the fact that he was invited on to Cirque du Soleil?
Yes.
He was writing about Tony Adams on Strictly Come Dancing. So the next time Tony's on, we must ask him about his invitation.
Ask him.
On to Cirque du Soleil.
Okay. Well, that's the beauty of working with Tony Cascarino, is that you can be talking about the intricacies of the game of football and then he throws that kind of curveball in.
What was the line? Yes, I can see myself in a leopard leotard.
Oh, we're all thinking, we really want to see that. I really want to see that.
Right. Okay, listen, I can tell you now, I can promise you now, I am less irate about Manchester United's result against Brentford.
Thank God for that.
Than I am about the end of that Chelsea match. So me being a much more relaxed Hugh Wisencroft is up next on the game.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts. Calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Brentford Community Stadium was bouncing on Saturday evening as Brentford beat Manchester United 4-0. All the goals coming in the first half. Erik ten Hag becomes the first United manager to lose their first two games since John Chapman in 1921. It was also Brentford's first league win over Manchester United for 86 years, so one to savour. For many people, though, it was a new low for United. Seven straight away Premier League defeats, four on the bounce for them. Alisson, you were there. Before we slate Manchester United, excellent from Brentford.
I honestly haven't had that much fun at a stadium, I don't know, maybe ever. Because when I'm watching Liverpool, there's always that slight nervousness. But when you're not invested romantically in a team, but just admire them, and they do what they did. Everything about it was, from talking about Brentford now, was spot on, tactically prepared beautifully, set up beautifully. Even at the end, when Thomas Frank took the team around the stadium in a very, very slow lap of honour. It could be possible, as we've been talking about people over-celebrating things, you could have thought, nah, it's getting a little sickly sweet now. It's just one game in the season. It somehow he pulled it off that it did not feel like an overreaction. And when I asked him about it afterwards, he said there was just so much joy. I just wanted to do something with it and feel it and make sure everyone was connected, and it was just absolutely splendid day out.
The other thing I'd just like to say on Brentford before we undoubtedly move on is that, like Alisson said, in terms of the tactics of that match, but everything they do just makes sense, and that is just such a contrast with Manchester United. When you look at the signings, young Aaron Hickey is a wing fullback, very, very talented player, bringing him in. Contrast that with Ben Mee, experienced Premier League centre-half who fits the bill of being strong from set pieces and throw-ins and in the air. You lose Christian Eriksen, what do you go and do? You sign Mikael Damsgaard, the younger, arguably with more potential and a longer career ahead of him. It all just makes sense, and you could see that on the pitch. And that's why, yes, it's obviously hugely shocking for them to beat Manchester United, but actually when you break it down, it's not that surprising really.
They are everything that Man United aren't as a football club. United, there's a vision that everyone's sort of invested in, and they have a strategy, and everyone's on the same page entirely. I did a preview for this game, and I went to Thomas Frank's press conference on Friday, and like he's so like emotionally intelligent as well.
Oh, goodness, yes.
He just no, I mean, he's so open. There's no agenda or anything. He's just so open and sort of, you could see him and so like enthusiastic about everything. I think he's somebody you just love to play for.
There was a chance in the, you went to the pre-match, post-match, as you can imagine, it's not often that packed at Brentford. Absolutely packed, and everyone was late coming to the press conference. Both managers were, but the room was packed. And Christian Eriksen had been booed by a proportion, not everyone, but by a proportion of the home fans. And if you think about the Christian Eriksen fairy tale, it was a slight disconnect there. Should they have done that? Shouldn't they have done that? So Thomas Frank was asked, should your fans have been booing Christian Eriksen on his return to Brentford, where, you know, he was a bit of an icon briefly. And Thomas Frank managed, just to illustrate Gregor's point about his emotional intelligence, he managed to tell off the fans for doing it without alienating the supporters at all. He was just saying, I don't think that's very classy. I'm not going to tell the supporters what to do. I think every returning player to this stadium should be applauded, but I'm not going to. It's not for me, not the classy thing to do. And then afterwards he said he'd be phoning him up, asking him if he's all right, how he's settling in Manchester, how his family are. Not, ha, 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 we wanted you to stay and look how it's turning out for you at Old Trafford. absolutely full of class, that bloke.
The only unfortunate thing is he actually asked the fans not to do that on Friday in the press conference. So as much as they love him, they didn't listen on that one.
But he gave them. He wouldn't dream of.
No, I know. You're right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, but just everything that makes Brentford so special and like is kind of such a jarring contrast to what make Man United so miserable now. The thing I wrote on Friday was like, when was the last player? I know we've said this before, but how many players in the last decade that Manchester United have signed have ever improved? And like every single player that Brentford sign, they improve, like they flourish, they develop them. And now you can't, like, you could say Bruno in his first in his first period of his career, but even he's drifted, and like there's just no one now. And I did the numbers. They've spent 1.35 billion on players, Man United, in the last decade. £970 million net spend, and Brentford have turned a £23 million profit.
I'm not exaggerating, but Christian Eriksen, after his cardiac arrest, he said quite quickly after his cardiac arrest, "My only ambition is to represent Denmark again at the World Cup. That's what I want." And Thomas Frank phoned him up and said, "Well, why don't you do that with us?" Brentford, the only club that made the offer, who dared to take a risk on a chap with a heart starter device. So he goes to Brentford and everyone goes, "Oh my goodness, yes, we'd forgotten just how brilliant he is at passing the ball, this vision, la la la." I actually think now, having seen this game, he might not be a starter for Denmark if he carries on playing for Manchester United, whereas if he'd stayed with Brentford, he would be a absolute certain starter for Denmark.
Old Trafford's like a vortex that talent just swirls into and withers and dies.
He will start for Denmark at the World Cup. He's pretty good. But
will he by November if he carries on with that?
He will.
Carries on.
Talisman,
carries like, on suffering the way he's suffering
good
now.
For them. He's pretty good for them because they've had a plan under a pretty...
No. Damsgaard didn't even get on. Right, okay, he's only just signed and he wasn't up to speed, but he didn't even get on. Imagine that Brentford team with Damsgaard in it and you're thinking, what formation am I going to play in a tricky game as Denmark manager? I might start with Damsgaard and not with Eriksen.
Okay, all right. I should explain why I'm sort of less angry about Manchester United than even the Chelsea game. Like it's expectation. Mm. I expected, as I pointed out earlier, VAR to do something because that's what it's there to do. I don't expect anything from Manchester United. And the main reason is, it is so easy for Manchester United to look around the league that they are in at all of these other clubs. They were given a lesson in everything that you just mentioned, Gregor, by Brighton last week, Brentford this week, to see other clubs with good structures, mm-hmm. with good recruitment, who have a plan, pick up the phone if you really are that interested in learning how some of the best clubs in the best league in the world are turning a profit, are improving players, are scouting, all of these things, including tactics, by the way. Graham Potter last week, Thomas Frank this week, you know, Erik ten Hag might have a great reputation, might have won titles where he's been in the Eredivisie. You know, he needs to get something out of this group of players, and he's not going to do it this way on the showing of the first 2 weeks. But I wasn't disappointed by it. I didn't expect Manchester United to get a result. I said before, and this is the reason that I don't want to go over the top with Manchester United, because I need to be fair. Everything that I could say about Manchester United now, we've said about Arsenal in the past, slated them for poor results, no vision, no strategy.
We have.
So I need to be fair. Manchester United deserve the criticism in all of these regards. Arsenal also went backwards for two seasons before they went forward. If you follow that pattern, it's reasonable to assume that Manchester United could get worse, and this might not even be their lowest point before we see any improvement from them. Thomas Clark.
I'm going to take over briefly, Hugh, as host, because I have two questions, and they both apply to all of you. So I've got one question, which is for Alison, and then for you, Hugh, and I've got another question, which is for Gregor, and then for you, Hugh. The first one is on Erik ten Hag. We're talking about Thomas Frank and his persona, both on the pitch, walking those players round, and in press conferences. Alison, you have absolutely torn him to shreds in mm-hmm. your report today. I want to know what your reading of him was, because you have such a wonderful reading of personalities and people. That's why you like me so much. What did you make of him after that game? And then, Hugh, equally, what do you make as a fan of hearing him?
Well, I did think, Ralf Rangnick, that's a new low in terms of lack of personality and being downbeat and not even trying to big up your players after a defeat with Manchester United. And then in comes Erik ten Hag, who makes Ralf Rangnick look like the most dynamic personality you'll ever meet at a discotheque. So I was shocked. I was shocked by the fact he doesn't get out of his seat. He just sits and makes notes. There's no encouragement to his players. There's no connection with his players whatsoever. He comes into the packed press room I described. His answers to the myriad questions all comprised about, on average, 6 syllables. He doesn't expound on anything. And it's not about English not being your first language. He's got the words. He just hasn't got the desire to convey anything whatsoever. He looks so much like a man who's made the biggest mistake of his career. I can't believe for one second he's happy. And the lack of connection with the media, the supporters, the players, I can't believe they've gone a step down after Ralf Rangnick. That is the amazing thing. I thought I'd seen the rock bottom in terms of lack of charisma, but I did list today, and I actually ran out of room. I listed all the mistakes he made. This isn't just about United being run badly from on high, and it's going to be tough for any manager who comes in. He has been making the most abysmal mistakes. He plays Eriksen as a false nine, and then he plays him on a pivot with Fred, both of which are positions that Eriksen has never played before. Why would you do that?
So, Hugh, you interview a lot of managers and players. What do you make of his persona, his personality?
Well, there isn't one there, to be perfectly honest, at this point in time. He's just sort of a robotic character. Funny enough, though, the people that I'd spoken to in the Netherlands before Ten Hag was appointed, on the week he was appointed, said it's a strange appointment for Manchester United because he's seen here as a massive introvert who only likes to do the coaching on the pitch, you know, highly tactical, but sole focus is on the football. Great for a club like Ajax because there are so many big figures at the club who have their focus in other areas. He just wants to focus on the football and doesn't want any of the noise. He then jumps into the frying pan by going to Manchester United. And the only thing that I'm seeing from Ten Hag so far is that he isn't a Conte character who's going to wrestle a football club going in the wrong direction and turn it around top to bottom. You know, some of the things, the changes that he's making, you know, changing the dugouts around at the home, you know, at Old Trafford. You know, there are bigger things to worry about right now, Eric, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
But as a personality, my issue with it is, if he's going to be a good coach and that's his focus and that's where we want him to do his work, he needs to be supported. Those around aren't very good at their jobs, clearly, one. And two, that clear out that so many people said Manchester United needed for the last 3 seasons at least. You know, we're just being reminded it does need to happen. The idea that Ten Hag was going to squeeze, you know, blood out of a stone here and suddenly turn around some of these players that have been awful for seasons into, like, really good players now. Please, can we all just get on board with the fact that Man United just need to get all these players out the door? And if that's going to take 3-4 seasons, which I think I've always said it's going to take a long time because of the size of their contracts and the fact that they've played so badly, then you just have to go through that period of pain.
But he's not just dealing with what he's inherited. He's making what he's inherited worse. I mean, his decisions were all wrong. I didn't see any sign of someone who's come in with a tactical master plan of how to, A, get through the short-term problems at Man United and then work towards longer-term problems. What's he doing playing Martinez at centre-back? And I don't believe he's 5'9", he's 5'7". What's he doing? What's he doing that against a team like Brentford, who are very, very big?
Well, exactly, which leads me beautifully, it's almost like we planned this, but we didn't, on to my next question, which is for Gregor, about Martinez. Because, Hugh, you talked about clear out and you talked about what Ten Hag wants and maybe what he didn't get. This is a player that he wanted. I want this guy. He's going to come.
Because everyone wants a player they've worked with.
Exactly.
Well, Timber was his first choice, remember?
Well, true, he still pushed through with the idea that I want this guy to play left side of the central of defence. Gregor, central defenders shorter than 6 foot in the Premier League going to work?
Shorter than 5'9".
Look, there's sub 6 foot central defenders who've done very well in the game.
Yeah,
it's possible.
But I mean, referring back to Tony's column again this morning, I challenged him. Obviously, he was a big guy whose whole game was based around bullying centre halves. But he said the only centre half that he ever played who was short that ever succeeded was Lothar Matthäus, and that's a pretty high bar.
Yeah, look there's, you could talk about Baresi and Cannavaro, but he's neither of those players, and he's someone who's really, I think, has been a midfielder as well in his time. So,
but he's also very slight, which is Tony Cascarino's other point, is that he's not big and bulky. He's a very small guy.
Look, I think that this won't be a major issue a lot of the time, most of the time, for Manchester United. It shouldn't be, particularly because they're going to be the team they should be the team who've got most of the ball, and the occasions in which he's like stuck underneath a lofted ball, like he was when Ben Mee was kind of able to just hold an arm on top of him and say like, I'm going to head this, I think they should be fairly rare too. And you can use his body in a different way. I'm 6'1", I'm not the tallest for a centre half. I remember playing against Akinfenwa, like, never play against a bigger striker in your life. You couldn't foul him, like, it was so easy. You could climb all over him and things like that. So he'll do well to give away a foul. If he's good enough at it can not be a problem, if you know what I mean. But Ivan Toney is probably one of his hardest opponents in the whole Premier League he came up against this season, because he's incredible in there. Only time will tell.
There have been enough
examples in the past of players who have been good enough and it's not been an issue, their height, and they've still been some of the best defenders in the world.
It's too late for those words to mean anything, because now everyone's seen what Thomas Frank's done, targeted his lack of stature. And I actually disagree with you. I think you can be relatively slight as a defender in a back three. Four at the back, you need to be a commanding height and presence.
The one thing I would say is that the mind goes back to a very similar game to this, which was Brentford beating Arsenal on the first game of last season, and the Sky Sports pundits have spent about half an hour talking about how much of an issue Ben White's going to have, because he had exactly the same thing happen. They just spent £50 million on him, and it wasn't really an issue for the rest of the season. So let's not go overboard, I think. Let's give a guy a chance.
I do think Erik ten Hag's got a huge problem. Read Paul Hurst in the Times today, just talking about the fact that Man United were made to train on Sunday after that poor performance, the running that they did, but also how Cristiano Ronaldo is cutting a bit of a unhappy figure, shall we say. And I think Erik ten Hag, as Paul alludes to, is getting a bit fed up with that situation. And we could talk for another 10 minutes about Ronaldo. I'm sure we will in due course. Big game for Manchester United next, up against Liverpool. Can't wait for that one, by the way. Old Trafford next Monday. Maybe we should have a special pod just for that game. Anyway, we'll see how it goes. So you may have read a wonderful serialisation in the Times, the inside story of how Sir Alex Ferguson resigned on the eve of the now legendary 1998-99 treble season. Well, today there's even more. Check it out on the Times app. You get the story of Steve McClaren's arrival at the club as a coach and the wall of testosterone that hit him walking in to that Old Trafford training ground. The book itself is called 1999, Manchester United, the Treble and All That. It's by our very own Matt Dickinson, who joins us now on the Game Podcast. Hi, Matt.
Morning.
Tell me, why did you decide to write this book? Because you're not a big Manchester United fan or anything like that. So what got you into it?
Well, there's a few things. I mean, it could be the most obvious of just, you know, it remains the obviously the most successful season by an English club. You know, Liverpool, Man City have, you know, been chasing quadruples and fallen short, which just shows how damn hard it is. But I think it's much more than that. Obviously, there was absolutely sort of, you know, unforgettable drama, probably the most dramatic season ever. But I think the biggest thing, which is possibly going to sound particularly poignant, even cruel to any Man United fans listening, is that I found the characters at the time absolutely fascinating. It was a dressing room packed full of huge personalities, as we serialised on the day one, Teddy Sheringham and Roy Keane having a massive fallout. Yeah, there were bust-ups. Yeah, this was this phenomenally successful team, and yet within it, there was this absolutely bubbling mass of egos, hard men, absolutely committed, driven, and brilliant footballers. And it just made for this incredible cocktail. And I just loved, I've spoken to most of them, you know, to Beckhams, to Schmeichels, to Yorks and Cole, to Gary Neville, et cetera, Scholes, et cetera, to talk through it. And they, I've, I think, loved reminiscing about it as much as I did.
The magnitude of those characters, who are the biggest that you met? Obviously, they're reflecting on some time ago now, but when you put all the stories together, who stood out in that changing room?
Well, the interesting thing was just to see how sort of, you know, perspectives change as well. I mean, it was, you know, Teddy Sheringham used to have a reputation for being, you know, incredibly aloof, you know, when we were sort of dealing with him in the time. And actually, it was really interesting to sit down with him, and he was one of the most reflective about that aloofness. Was almost a sort of, you know, facade for actually he felt he never fitted into this dressing room. There was that class of 92 cabal. There was Keane, who he had this massive fallout with. Keane didn't speak to him for 3 years. Andy Cole didn't speak to him at all. And, you know, it was really interesting to hear how he sort of struggled to fit. You know, he scored one of the most iconic, famous goals in the history of Man United, but he remembers it as a really tough time. He had a massive bust-up with Ferguson during the season as well. So, you know, I just loved reveling and relishing the details again of what was going on behind the scenes, and at the same time, obviously, reliving some of the most epic matches ever staged. I mean, you know, obviously there was the Villa Park FA Cup replay against Arsenal, which was, you know, possibly the most dramatic domestic match ever, you know, ever played. There was, you know, Turin away with Keane. There was obviously, before we even get near the Nou Camp, you know, I mean, in the serialisation, I don't think David Beckham has had a mention. And yet this, of course, was the year when he started the season straight after the 98 World Cup as, you know, the villain of the entire nation. There was the effigy, the sarong, and he was hated. He was absolutely loathed. And of course, by the end of the season, he's won everyone around and won the treble.
It doesn't seem like they liked each other that much, given everything that you've been saying. Like, it doesn't seem like this changing room of team spirit, you know, that led them towards all these trophies. Can you put your finger on why they were such a successful team then?
Well, I think they did. Obviously, you know, the class of 92 were, you know, not just teammates, but absolutely, you know, lifelong friends. Gary Neville and David Beckham, you know, absolutely best friends. Nicky Button, Ryan Giggs, etc. But I think, you know, just bringing those personalities to the fore shows the genius of Alex Ferguson. His idea of a football team was that it should reflect his personality. And obviously, we know very well that his personality is intimidating. It's, you know, physical, could be bullying. And he wanted to be aggressive, and he wanted footballers who reflected that personality on the pitch. And I think, you know, he surrounded himself with them. Obviously, a cost of that was that you would get clashes, but, you know, he had such a scale of personality that he could keep them in check. And I think that is, you know, again, it's test. I think the book is, you know, in part, it's a study of greatness. You know, I don't think anyone would dispute that word when they think of that manager and that team. And Ferguson's greatness was in being able to handle, you know, these extraordinary figures. And you know, you can imagine Man United fans are reading it and thinking, do we have even one of those characters or personalities now? Never mind a whole team of them.
Matt Dickinson, thank you very much. If you want to delve back into the heyday of Manchester United, 1999, Manchester United, the treble and all that is out this Thursday. You can read the serialisation. Such great insight on the Times app right now. The City Ground played host to top-flight Premier League football for the first time in 23 years, and it ended triumphantly with a 1-0 victory over West Ham, which, as you might expect, involved a pretty big slice of good fortune for Forest. And the pre-match scenes were one to savour. We've got to speak to our resident Nottingham Forest fan here, John Jackson, the producer of the Game podcast, who was inside the ground, abandoned his mum on her birthday, no less, to make sure he was inside the ground. Disgraceful, but did you enjoy it?
It wasn't a big birthday. I did enjoy it. Yeah, no, I took her for brunch. Can I just defend myself? I took her for brunch and I said, look, if I do a tweet while you go and order and someone happens to have a ticket, is that all right? Is it acceptable that you go to the garden centre alone? And she said, yes. So I put out a tweet and I checked the DMs after the brunch and, you know, a former Nottingham Forest player had DM'd me and left me a ticket on reception. We will name no names, but he was a very good left winger. Did he play with Gregor?
Was he on the bench?
Well, who knows? Anyway, so yes, it was fantastic. Obviously, the atmosphere was ridiculous. They did plan, the Forest supporters group do sort of plan these big sort of gestures with banners and things like that, and something went wrong, like things didn't turn up, but they still managed to provide a lot of fans to people. And being sitting in that searing heat yesterday was actually quite welcome that there was fans. But yeah, in terms of the atmosphere there, I mean, you've got kids who've never seen Nottingham Forest play in the Premier League, so obviously that's very special. Fathers, mothers, grandfathers, grandparents, whatever, you know, being able to take these kids and not only get enjoyment themselves from seeing Forest back in the Premier League, but also, you know, the joy you can see on their faces as they're taking kids. It was very nice.
Atmosphere?
Yeah, ridiculous all the way through.
Good.
Just, you know, constant singing. But that always happens at the City Ground.
I know. I know it's an excellent place for atmosphere. I wondered whether it surpassed what it's usually like because it was such a game of magnitude.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I think there was a lot more consistent. There was just that feeling of unease because obviously being so close to winning your first Premier League game at home in 23 years. We are unbeaten, by the way, at home in the Premier League in 23 years. Just saying. Yeah, I think there was just that weird anticipation made everyone a bit more on edge. So there was a lot more shouting and berating of players. And Benrahma, who was very keen to tell everyone to be quiet when he scored the goal that then got chalked off. So
yeah. Good. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it, John. Thank you for joining us on the podcast. Should speak to our resident Nottingham Forest ex-player, no less. Surely the fee's gone up, mate. They're a Premier League club now. Taiwo Awoniyi's goal, very fortunate. Do you think it was a deserved victory for Forest? As I said, there was a fair bit of luck in there, including a Declan Rice missed penalty, Benrahma hitting the underside of the crossbar. But
Fornals.
This was the performance of the weekend, genuinely, that made me feel worse about Manchester United. Because I was like, if a championship side who have bought 15 players now under Steve Cooper can have, granted, you know, there is probably a golfing class between them and West Ham United individually, but be so competitive in a game against a team that qualified for Europe last year, and Man United are 4-0 down at halftime to Brentford, I was a bit like, look, there's serious issues at United, but all credit to Forest.
Absolutely. It's kind of, as the number of players they're bringing in just ratchets up every few days, it's, I don't know, but my only unease is just knowing about the owner and slightly worried that people have got a bit of amnesia about what happened before, prior to the 12 months that was a bit of a miracle and they got promoted. He's just addicted to signing players. And look, I understand the argument that everyone is making quite forcefully about Forrest needing to do this because they shipped out 6 loans, they released, I think they released something like 12 players overall. I understand they need to do it, but it's a huge job to kind of knit this together and keep some semblance of the kind of unity and team spirit and, you know, I don't know, just plain old happiness for the players who helped them get promoted. And yeah, it's going to be some task, but the early signs were good, and some of the early signs from the signings too were very good. Lewis O'Brien was outstanding. So much energy. He's just got a bit of everything. He can drive forward with the ball. He's really good, kind of positionally intelligent. Loves a tackle. He's got a bit of everything. I thought he was excellent. Harry Toffolo, who Tom will know very well from his time at Lincoln. They also signed from Huddersfield. Brilliant, particularly in the build-up to the goal. There's some positive signs. I thought Awoniyi was a menace. He looked kind of a bit like he maybe not going to put every chance that falls his way away. But he looked a real menace. And I thought Nico Williams at right back as well, on the ball in particular, was a real kind of attacking force. I'm not entirely convinced about him defensively yet, but certainly hugely positive. Just to kind of get that monkey off their back and to kind of have liftoff in the Premier League. Massive day for Forest.
I think Greg has said it before several times on the podcast, but it comes back to Steve Cooper, doesn't it? And this kind of potential culture clash with the owner, because the three players that Greg has just highlighted there, they're Steve Cooper players. They're young, hungry players that have grown in the game, and they're being given a chance under a manager who gets a lot out of young English talent. This seems to be his background in coaching. Then when you see rumours about signing Uwa from the Ligue 1, from Lyon, and you're thinking, oh, is that a bit of a celebrity superstar signing? Is that what they need? You know, how's he going to work alongside Lewis O'Brien? That's where the kind of clash might come in the final weeks of the window, where they move from signing these players that are very much going to fit in with what Steve Cooper wants to do, and then maybe signing some box office superstar names that might not work.
Look, he's outward facingly, at least he seems to be on board with it. You know, I think he's happy to get the support. And I should, as I say, in the last 12 months, they made big changes behind the scenes in terms of bringing Dane Murphy from Barnsley as CEO, sort of improving the recruitment structure, which is and getting some good data analysis involved and things like that. So I think we've got to give them benefit of the doubt. It's going to be a huge challenge to knit the squad together now, and there's going to be a lot of unhappy players. And one of his biggest strengths actually last season was, he was Forrested hoarded players for years, and he managed to kind of keep even people who are on the periphery and the fringes, you keep them happy and keep them invested. So if you can do it again, I mean, it's some job.
Yeah, it will be some job. Good to see Nottingham Forest off the mark in front of their home fans. I haven't got any real concerns for West Ham United. I think they could have easily scored in this game. You know, great to see VAR chalking off a goal, by the way, for two players running into each other. Why would you want to get involved when someone, you know, pulls someone's hair when you can disallow goals for that? You know, that's what it's all about, hey, with the old VAR. Anyway, I'm not going to dwell on it too much. Hopefully West Ham get off the mark very, very soon as well. Before we leave you, please do read an article on the Times app right now. Jonathan Northcroft, just a great dissection of assists. Has football become too obsessed with assists? But it goes back to the origin of it, why we even discuss it, the importance of it. And we might as well do the same here on the Game podcast. Alison, I'll start with you. What do you think about maybe your favourite assist, but also the importance of assists in the game? Do we maybe dwell on them a little bit too much?
I've always been in love with assists. And my favourite player of all time was the king of the pre-assist, Jari Litmanen. So yes, I love an assist. In fact, one of the best showreels you'll ever watch isn't a showreel of goals, it's a showreel of Michael Laudrup's assists, where he would squirm the ball through the eye of a needle to reach the player he knew was going to run from out of the picture. So I probably would rather spend an hour watching assists than goals. That is the truth. I'm not just saying it because we're discussing assists. I absolutely adore assists. I tested it out on my son. I said, do you know what your favourite assist is? And he knew straight away. And I wonder how many fans out there would know straight away. His favourite assist is Cesc Fabregas to Schürrle when it's second coming of Mourinho, so around 2015, first game of the season, and they won the title.
Yeah, against Burnley.
Against Burnley. It's all context. It's all context, isn't it? But the fact that he knew without missing a heartbeat what his favourite assist was, and also he knew what my favourite assist was. We're such a lovely close-knit family. So my favourite assist is my first ever trip to Anfield, the 7-0 against Spurs, the seventh goal, the ball, there's a rare Spurs corner, the ball's comes out of defence through Kenny Dalglish, the ball goes to the left wing, and right in front of me Stevie Highway collects the ball and doesn't stop running in doing so and keeps running and crosses the ball without needing to look at Terry McDermott, who's made the run the full length of the pitch to just head it in. And that, to me, was sort of cemented my absolute adoration of A, football, B, Liverpool, and C, assists.
I thought you would have gone, one of my favourites, Xavi Alonso's, the left-footed hook to Luis Garcia against Sunderland over the shoulder. Please tell me you remember that. If you don't, check it out on YouTube. Unbelievable.
Well, he was another king of the assists.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Tom, what do you think?
Oh, so many suggestions. And I think, as Alison's point with her son rightly proves, everyone has their favourite assists. I mean, arguably quicker than goals. I mean, I sent the message out on Twitter and to some of my friends, and the responses were immediate, instantaneous. Lots of suggestions for a player that I know Gregory is going to mention, so I'll leave that one out. Listener Stephen Adams agreed with Alisson's son that Fabregas against Burnley, which, if you've not seen it, is absolutely beautiful. Fakes the shoot, kind of cushions a little volley into Schürrle's path. Superb. Lots of suggestions for David Silva, knocking it up on the volley and then hitting it straight through to Edin Dzeko against Manchester United in that mauling. Let's be honest, it's probably about 15 for David Silva that you could have. Paul Scholes, similarly, for me and for my brother, against Milan for Manchester United, flicking the ball over the defence in kind of one movement for Wayne Rooney to bound through and score. Cyril suggests Rooney to Van Persie, obviously, for that wonderful volley. Dave picks David Beckham to Ronaldo for Real Madrid. Obviously, that combination would have happened lots of times, but if you look
that's my fave.
But the fizzed cross, the curl that just like evades drifts, the defender's head, and Ronaldo hits it on the volley.
Oh,
absolutely beautiful.
Beautiful.
I'm going to. My friend James suggested this one, and I agree with him because it kind of combines something else about football that I love, which is a tackle. Wayne Rooney for DC United, when he sprints back, he's the only man. He sprints back about half the length of the pitch,
snaps a player, gets up,
absolutely cuts a guy in half, gets up, knocks it out of his feet. And it's the way that he kind of hoofs it, in a way that, you know, we all hoof the ball just to kind of clear it. But a Wayne Rooney hoof essentially ends up as the most precise and perfect cross for a guy to attack it and head it in. Absolutely superb.
Yeah, there are loads of good ones. And you named a couple there. There was a specialist in assists that a lot of football fans love as well, Gregor.
Goody. Specialist with his heel as well. I mean, I just kind of had a really nice half an hour earlier just watching some of his. His most famous is the back heel for Benzema against Deportivo La Coruña in 2009-10. And it's like, when he's clean through on goal, he's in the penalty box, there's no one in front of him except the goalkeeper, everyone's shooting, and he back heels at a slight angle as well, which, you know, just leaves everyone flummoxed, and Benzema just taps into an empty net. It's just absolutely magnificent. And he of course did something similar for Zinedine Zidane, although it was,
I mean, you say similar, I hadn't
no
seen
it wasn't
this,
you know, it was
morning.
Similar in that it was an assist with his back heel, but it was bizarre because he's kind of 25 yards out, facing away from the opponent's goal, and back somehow knows that Zidane is making a run into the box as the Sevilla, I think it's the Sevilla defenders are coming out, and he threads a ball in between their defence, splits their defence with a back heel for Zidane to score. It was just, that was more like jarring, but I don't know actually, which one's better? Which one do you think's better?
I think the second one's better, because that is, you know, when you hit a button when you're playing like Pro Evo or FIFA, and they're not looking the right way, the player.
It's the wrong button. But you're hitting the wrong button.
But obviously, you can see everything, right? Because you're watching the full pitch, and they make a pass, and you think no player could ever do that because they haven't got eyes in the back of their head. Guti does that like he's got eyes in the back of his head. Like, it's incredible.
It is. But no one doesn't shoot when they're actually one-on-one with the goalkeeper as well. No one does that either.
It's the unnecessary nature of the Benzema.
Although he already was interviewed for the Benzema, and he said, I didn't do it for aesthetic reasons. I mean, I'm not sure how much I believe this, but he was like, I just think about the practicality. I'm a pragmatist on the pitch, he said. I thought, what's the easiest way to guarantee a goal? Yeah. I'm not sure that's true.
Because it's on his right foot. That's the only way. He just doesn't fancy shooting with his right.
The one thing we should say about Johnny's piece, which is a joyous piece, and you can tell he really enjoyed, as he said, going down some rabbit holes on YouTube. But the line he opens with at the start kind of sums up the problem with assists, which is he cites Maradona's goal, famous goal against England in the 86 World Cup, and no one ever knows who got the assist for that. But Hector Enrique, who it was, says, as a gag, which is, with a pass like that, you could hardly miss. So, obviously, it's a little sideways pass in his own half. He would have got an assist for that. So, there is some kind of issue with the metric now, and everything is so, you know, stats driven.
We have key passes as a metric now, and I think key passes.
We have expected assists as well.
Expected assists.
Yeah, we have second assists as well.
Yeah.
The pass before the pass is very important too.
Come in next week on the Game Podcast. Yes, your favourite pass before the pass.
There'll be some good ones too. Anyway, thank you all. Alison Rudd, Gregor Robertson, Tom Clark for being with me for the past hour or so. And all of you for listening too. We will be back on Thursday. Plenty more to discuss, I am sure. Particularly when it comes to Cristiano Ronaldo. He might be out the door by then. Aubameyang might be in at Chelsea. Who knows what else? We'll see you then. But in the meantime, make sure you're subscribed both to the podcast and to the Times app. Download it wherever you get your apps from. You can check it out online as well, thetimes.co.uk/the game. We'll see you soon.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.